Well, there's no doubt humankind is at a turning point in the quest for extraterrestrial life. We now have the capacity, don't we, to detect Earth-like planets around other stars. In a moment, back with more with The Crowded Universe and Alan Boss, astronomer on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with astronomer Alan Boss here. Alan, as we move ahead with the Kepler in that mission, what's after that? Have they planned that far?
NASA has a lot of plans for what could come after Kepler. The key thing, though, is for Kepler to first tell us how frequently Earths are, because what comes next depends on how many Earths there are. If Earths are quite common, as I expect is going to be the case, then that means we don't have to look that hard to find Earths around other nearby stars. Whereas if Earths are a little bit less common, like maybe one out of 1,000 stars or something like that, then that means we'll have to go farther out in space to be able to take pictures of Earth, and so it'll be that much harder. And you'll want to design your next space telescope a little bit differently.
The primordial soup is probably the same. Is that why we say we need water, we need to be a certain distance from our sun, from our star, and then we might be able to have similarities in life?
Well, water is this wonderful medium because it allows chemical reactions to go on and be carried out. It allows molecules to be floating around and find each other and combine and form ever more complicated molecules. And so water is really pretty essential as a solvent for allowing the sort of chemistry that all human life is based on and that all terrestrial life, in fact, is based on. So for carbon-based chemistry, you really want to have carbon-based compounds floating in water, basically, in order to get that prebiotic soup cooking and bubbling and boiling and producing ever more complex organisms.
And it seems that water's pretty prevalent, right?
It is indeed quite common. Whenever we look out in the galaxies, other galaxies as well as within our own galaxy, we can find evidence for water, water masers, water molecules, precursors of water, OH, hydroxyl molecules, hydrogen, oxygen. All the basic chemicals you need to make water are there. We know water is everywhere.
If we are at the end of the life form, okay, you know, life evolves to us, let's say, even though maybe dolphins may be higher than us. I'm not sure anymore. but if life evolves to us, might there be some other form beyond us, whatever the next evolution might be out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, human beings, depending on what you want to call a human being, have only been around for maybe 160,000, 200,000 years or so. So, 500,000 years ago, we were not what we are now. And so if we can manage not to kill ourselves off or make the planet totally inhospitable for life over the next, say, 100,000 years, I would expect that human beings might very well begin morphing into something else. In fact, given the ability we have for cloning things in the lab these days, we could actually, of course, accelerate the pace of evolution considerably if people start making preferred choices for what they want their children to be like based on genetic cloning techniques. Human beings could evolve into something else on a much faster time scale than what nature would do on its own.
Alan, tell us a little bit about you. How did you get involved in this, interested in this?
I mostly became interested in extrasolar planets from several points of view. First, I did my PhD thesis work on trying to understand how stars form, because I understand that the star formation process is the beginning of the first act, as it were, of the play that eventually leads to planet formation. So I was supposed to be working on planet formation for my thesis work, but I told my thesis advisor, I think we need to understand how stars form first. And so from a theoretical point of view, that got me interested in trying to understand how stars and planets form together. But what really crystallized my direct interest in NASA's efforts to find extrasolar planets was back in 1988, I was asked to join a committee at NASA headquarters, which was charged with trying to understand what NASA should be doing in order to start thinking about building space telescopes to find extrasolar planets. And so that was a little over 10 years ago, and I've been actively involved in NASA's efforts ever since, run in the various committees they've had. And right now I serve as an advisor to NASA headquarters to try to keep track of the efforts that NASA has underway to build telescopes that will go beyond what the Kepler mission will do and take those next steps that we talked about a few moments ago, depending on how frequently Earths are.
Alan, where are we as a nation compared to other countries? Of course, we were always ahead in the space race once we zoomed past the Soviets at the time. But where are we now?
Well, we actually are, I would say, pretty much running neck and neck in many ways with Europe in terms of what we can do in astronomy these days. And in terms of ground-based telescopes, the Europeans have this wonderful array of four very large telescopes down in the upper Atacama Desert in Chile, four 8-meter telescopes, which rival anything that the U.S. has to put up. The U.S. has 8-meter telescopes and 10-meter telescopes as well, but the VLT, they're all in one site combined together. They can be combined as interferometer to do things that the U.S. telescopes, by and large, cannot do. So our main competition these days is the Europeans. Certainly in ground-based astronomy, they are doing wonderful stuff. And in space-based astronomy, they don't quite have the budget that NASA has, but when they decide to go after something, they can do something quite important. For example, the Kepler mission, which is going to be launched in March of next month, is already been raced, as it were, by a French mission, Corot, the one that announced a planet yesterday.
Right.
And Corot was launched 2 years ago. It was a French and European Space Agency mission. And Corot has a good chance to steal some of the cream from Kepler's crop of looking for planets, because Corot is also a transit photometry mission. It will be looking at stars and looking to see if they blink periodically, implying that there's a planet passing in front of the star and in orbit around the star.
Why aren't we working together?
We often do work together. For example, the Hubble Space Telescope is a joint U.S.-European mission.
Mm-hmm.
The James Webb Space Telescope has European participation with the U.S. as a lead.
The ISS?
Certainly the International Space Station has many nations contributing. So on these large projects, it is the way to go. On the other hand, occasionally people want to do things on their own, and so there's a friendly element of competition, I would say, involved. It's a good sort of competition. We all trying to egg each other on and see what wonderful things we can find. So that's a positive aspect. In fact, some of the large telescopes that NASA wants to build next, in particular, is something called a terrestrial planet finder that would actually be able to image nearby Earth and take their pictures. That sort of telescope probably is going to be so expensive that we will want to collaborate with the Europeans on that. So there's a joint task force, basically, between the U.S. and Europe, which is jointly trying to plan a mission that would be able to see Earth. And the Europeans call their telescope Darwin. The U.S. folks call theirs TPF, Terrestrial Planet Finder. So it's the TPF/Darwin initiative, which hopefully will eventually bear fruit.
When will we know exactly where life can exist on other planets like ours? How long do you think it'll take?
I think the key thing is to launch something like the Terrestrial Planet Finder Darwin mission, because that mission will be able to actually search nearby stars for Earth-like planets and tell us something about the atmospheres of those planets.
Which is critical, right?
Absolutely. That's the best we're going to be able to do for some time to come. And so those missions, if we decided to give the green light to them right now, I would expect that one of those could be launched and starting to take data roughly 10 years from now. It's not something we can do overnight because the technology is incredibly challenging, although a lot of it's been developed. So roughly 10 years from now, if we had the green light, we could start getting images back and seeing photos on the evening news and in our newspapers of nearby stars with planets and learning something about the atmospheres of the planets. In particular, there are basically four molecules we'll be looking for, which would be indicative of a habitable and possibly an inhabited planet. The most basic one is perhaps carbon dioxide and water. Those
mm-hmm.
are typical
Critical.
Molecules to be seen in terrestrial planets like Venus, Earth, and Mars. They have those molecules. But then beyond that, that just basically tells you that the planet is probably habitable, and we want to go beyond that and see if it actually is inhabited. And there are two molecules to look for there, basically, either oxygen or ozone, which are basically both proxies for the oxygen molecule, and also methane. Methane cannot stay in equilibrium with oxygen. The two will react and form other products. So if you see a planet which has both signatures of methane and oxygen or ozone in its atmosphere, that probably means that some sort of life forms are producing those two compounds. Photosynthesis, of course, produces the oxygen, and on the Earth, at least, the methane is produced by a combination of methanogenic bacteria
mm-hmm.
and, believe it or not, dairy cows.
Right, right.
Dairy cows, through belching and flatulence, produce a measurable amount of methane on our planet. So if we found a nearby world which had methane and oxygen on it, we probably would want to alert the American Dairy Association. They would probably get very excited about this.
What do you think's going on with Saturn's moon Titan, where they say now it rains methane?
That's a very intriguing place for telling us perhaps what the early Earth could have been like. Titan might very well be an excellent analog for what the early Earth would have been like. There are also, of course, just in the few weeks, there have been the announcement that we now know for sure that Mars has methane coming out of it right now. One of my colleagues at the Goddard Space Flight Center, Michael Mubin, and his team have found evidence for belching and burping of methane seasonally at certain areas on Mars. And so there's been a lot of debate for several years as whether or not those methane detections were real or not. I think they've now established that methane is there. It is coming out of the Mars surface.
They just don't know if it's volcanoes or organisms.
Right. It could very well be some sort of deep-seated life. We know within the Earth, for example, that there's even more biomass below the surface of the Earth than there is above the Earth. If you go drilling holes, you'll find evidence of life down at depth where we're normally is drilling for water and oil and other substances. There's a lot of stuff living down there in the rocks, and that's probably the situation going on in Mars right now. Even though there may not be much living on the surface of Mars, there could very well be abundant little creatures crawling around. Now, crawling's not quite the right word.
Well, no, you may be right. They could be crawling. Could they be insects? Could they have ants on Mars, let's say?
Well, I think that's probably a bit much, but you know, I'm not a biologist. I won't go too far, but I would certainly say there's a good chance for it being the single-cell creatures that we talked about that were on Earth the first few billion years. I don't think they've quite gotten to the point of the Cambrian explosion that we have had on Earth 500 million years.
Might they have had this, and then Mars, of course, loses its atmosphere, loses its oceans. Do you think at one time they might have had this?
I think it's a little bit unlikely because I believe that the evidence is that Mars had its water very early on within the first few hundred million years of its existence. And so I think there's just probably not enough time for life to evolve and get to the point of having snakes and insects on such a short time scale, given, again, the Earth as our analogy, where we know it took several billion years to get to that phase. So that's not to say, as we said, that there couldn't be some sort of bacteria or archaea single-celled organisms that did make it on Mars.
Well, something's making the methane, right?
And something's making the methane, yes, but as we say, it could be volcanoes, could be geochemical processing of rocks, could very well be some sort of methanogenic bacteria as well.
And so, what's your gut tell you? does a scientist go from the gut?
Scientists can go from the gut, and I suspect that there are some astrobiologists who know enough about it, they might have a good feeling for it. I will defer to my other colleagues. I would simply say, to my mind, it's a coin flip. I would say, given what I know, at least at this point, I'd say it's a 50% chance that it's abiotic, coming from just chemistry, and I'd say 50% chance maybe it is life. I think it's not a zero chance. It's an equally compelling hypothesis that there could be life there.
Are you familiar with the old work of Immanuel Velikovsky?
Yes, I've heard the name. Yes, indeed.
All right. He believes Venus, for example, was a captured comet, came into the solar system and got captured. What do you think?
I think that's not very well accepted these days, to put it mildly. I think we very much understand how Venus formed, the same sort of way that the Earth formed. When you do a calculation trying to understand how the Earth formed, you follow the process of having solids in orbit around the young star, orbit around and crash into each other and build larger and larger planets. A very common outcome of the process is to have two Earth-like planets. One more or less at Earth's position, one more or less at Venus's position, and a few other smaller things around. So it's not at all surprising that we have the current planetary configuration. There's no need to invoke anything strange or out of the ordinary. It's just a normal outcome of the planet formation process to end up with several terrestrial planets.
Ellen, why can't planets form on the same rotational area of a planet but on the other side? So, you know, they're not colliding, let's say. You know how we have them out now in the order that they're in. They're all in their same, you know, they're all in their own orbit. Why can't we have two planets in one orbit, but, you know, apart from each other?
Well, in the first place, such a configuration would not be very stable over the billions of years of the solar system history. So even if you managed to form it like that, it probably wouldn't stay there.
Get torn apart.
For us to see it, because perturbations from Jupiter managed to jiggle the planets around enough that situation would not be very stable. But to back up and say, is it likely to have happened in the first place? It's highly unlikely because the planet formation process is a fairly chaotic one. There are lots of bodies careening around it's sort of like billiards on a billiard table, with bodies bouncing off the cushions and coming back and smacking each other and occasionally sticking together and building a larger and larger planet. And that process goes on for, in the case of the Earth, something like 100 million years is how long it takes for the Earth to get basically 99.9% of its mass accumulated. And in that process of doing that, you pretty much sweep up everything in your neighborhood. And so it would be quite unlikely to manage to have two bodies, more or less the same size, form exactly 180 degrees out of phase with each other with respect to the orbits around the sun. That is just a vanishingly small probability. I don't think in all the hundreds and thousands of simulations that theorists have run, they've ever come across the calculation that ended up like that. I mean, it's not to say it's absolutely impossible. It's just highly unlikely.
What about the possibilities in our solar system that there's another planet, a planet X, that is so far out in its orbit that we just don't know where it is yet? Is it possible?
Oh, we know there are objects like that right now. That's one of the major goals of solar system astronomers, is to complete the census of our own solar system, where these are objects out in the Kuiper Belt, basically, objects like Sedna, which are...
But small. That's small.
Yes, they're small, and there might very well be one that's even larger out there. I mean, some of the ones that have been found, like the Eris, the one that Michael Brown found, which helped dethrone Pluto, it's roughly the same size as Pluto, which is roughly... 1/6 the mass of the moon. So by some people's definition, those objects should be called planets. They're big enough to be round and held together by gravity. There probably are many more objects like Eris out there just waiting for us to find them.
Could there be an Earth-like object out there in the solar system?
Well, probably not, just because it's, again, harder to build such large objects the farther out you go. There's just not much mass out there. Most of the mass when you form a protoplanetary disk tends to end up close to the star, and so you tend to get larger planets in closer than that. I can't say they can be ruled out. People will certainly be looking for it, and they have been looking for it. They haven't found one yet. So I think we can probably say it's unlikely there's anything quite as large as the Earth out there, but there are probably a lot more bodies that are the size of Pluto or thereabouts. So maybe a few times the size of Pluto.
Alan, where do you stand now on these theories of the multiverses, more than one universe?
I think it's wonderful. It's actually, to my mind, closer to being applied mathematics than astronomy, because it becomes very largely a mathematical exercise.
Uh-huh.
And if one can find measurable consequences of multiverses, where we can perhaps find something within our own universe that we can measure that would not have occurred if there was only a single universe, then I think that's wonderful. But otherwise, if it's to my mind at least, I'm happy trying to just understand how stars and planets form, because that's difficult enough, and I at least have the hope that I can make a prediction which can be tested within my lifetime to see if it really makes any sense or not. The multiverse stuff, is wonderful mathematics, and it may very well be real, but if we can't test it, it's hard to go much beyond that. It's hard to turn it from... into a real science without having that interplay between theory and observations.
On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being we know everything in this galaxy, where do you think we are knowledge-wise?
I would say we probably know, a 7. But I think we know more than half.
That's not bad.
But we've learned a tremendous amount in the last several hundred years of serious scientific discourse. And I think given another few hundred years, we will probably get up to a 9 on that scale. I think we really have learned an awful lot. We have, with these space telescopes we are building and planning on building, we will really clean up a lot with things like the Large Hadron Collider, just began operations. We're going to continue our knowledge of what's going on in the subatomic world. I think we are really a lot of the way there. That's not to say that there might not be some major surprises along the way, but I think by and large we have a tremendous feeling for what the universe is like, certainly compared to what we had knew even 100 years ago. 100 years ago we didn't even know the galaxies were there.
Alan, we're going to continue talking about the crowded universe. I really want to get your take now on the search for living planets and what could be out there. And then next hour we'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got our floating format, so in the last hour of the program tonight, Joshua Warren joins us with some incredible paranormal stories. We'll be back in just a moment with our guest, Alan Boss. We'll continue talking with him and take phone calls with him next hour. Okay, Alan, I know we're going to find these planets. We're going to come up with the theories on their atmosphere. But how will we know that they have some kind of life, whether it's microbial or creatures, or even intelligent life? How will we know unless we physically go to that planet?
Well, that's true. If we do find a planet which has carbon dioxide and water and methane and oxygen, there's always some small chance that somehow those molecules are there through abiotic processes, so we can never be 100% sure if that's all we know about the planet. So I suspect that if we manage to find such a nearby Earth, maybe 5 or 10 light years away, one of the things we're going to want to do next is to build a small spacecraft and fire it off in that direction as soon as we can. Wait, unfortunately, maybe 1,000 years for the information to come back to us.
Because, you know, it's got to be a better way.
It would be. If we were lucky to get something even up to something like 1% the speed of light, which would be quite a feat, it would, you know, take something like 100 years, a couple hundred years to get to it. Then, of course, it would send the take some pictures of a planet, send it back to us at the speed of light, so the return trip would go a lot faster. But you're still talking about something more than a human lifetime. So we'd have to sort of set up a holy priesthood of folks who are considered waiting for, you know, 1,000 years to pass by and remember to watch for that signal coming back from that star 1,000 years from now. Make sure you have the test pattern on ready to go and make sure you don't miss it when it comes back, because those will be fascinating pictures to see.
Okay, now let's assume that that's exactly the way it's got to be. We'll talk about bending space and time in a second for propulsion and travel. But let's assume that's the way you have to go. Now, to me, if we got to wait 500 to 1,000 years, it's kind of ridiculous, right?
It's a little depressing.
It is. It doesn't make any sense. We spend that kind of money and we don't get a return for those many years, and it doesn't make sense. So what's the purpose? If we're never going to be able to physically find out if there's life there, why spend all this money? Why even try?
Sure. Those are good questions. I think, though, that most people, most scientists, would be quite happy to find a world which did have methane and ozone on it. That would probably, from their point of view, make it quite clear that that was actually has life. If we could actually build another telescope, which is even larger than the ones that would be necessary to find those spectral signatures, we could go beyond that. We might be able to actually build a telescope eventually that was large enough to start giving us some feeling for whether or not that planet had seasons, whether or not it had cloud cover, oceans, that sort of thing. It would be very hard to get a very good picture of the planet, but by watching with enough time that planet evolves as it rotates around the sun, revolves around its sun, and rotates on its axis, we could learn a little bit more about the planet. It's not a huge amount of information, but it would certainly push us in that direction. But the key thing would be that if we found such a planet, it really would make the case that we probably are not alone in the universe. That is the key thing. That is, it's one thing to, for everyone to believe it, which I think most people do believe that there are other life forms in the universe, but to have scientific proof of it, that is something that which is rare, yet attainable.
You've got a great comment by Frank Drake on the back of your book, The Crowded Universe, and of course he heads up the SETI Institute. He's one of the big players here. Is this, and we know them well, they're friends of the program, they come on often, Seth Shostak and his group.
Yes.
Is this worthwhile, to try to find signals of extraterrestrial life?
I think absolutely, because it really requires very little resources to do that. It's in fact, you know, Frank Drake's original search effort was piggybacked basically on the large Arecibo telescope down in Puerto Rico, which was built for other purposes. But a lot of their searches have been done simply by using the radio telescope, whenever it's doing its other observations, at the same time pulling the signal off and looking to see if by some chance that telescope happens to be pointed towards something which is trying to send us a signal. So it's a very small incremental cost. Even the Allen telescope array that the SETI folks are building right now,
right, the new one,
Creek, with something, it has something on the order of 60, I think, telescope antennas right now. They're hoping to build up to something like 360, I believe. Its cost is on the order of tens of millions of dollars, which is really quite modest compared to...
It is modest, thanks to Paul Allen, of course. And
Microsoft, yes. And so he gave the money to get the array started. So that's a relative, on the scale of modern telescopes, that is a modest investment. And even though there's perhaps a small chance of success, when you multiply that small chance of success by the importance of what it could find, you come up with a factor which is not to be neglected. It really is worthwhile doing.
I wonder if Paul Allen wants his money back. Allen, after he left Microsoft, he bought Charter Communications, and there's talk now that's going to go bankrupt.
Well, he can always go to Hat Creek and take up a career as an astronomer, I'm sure.
Absolutely. They've probably got a chair named in his name, right?
They'll give him a workstation and a laptop and let him start crunching some of the data, I'm sure.
What will be the major breakthrough in your field that will just make all of us just go crazy, that will make me call up you or a scientist like you and say, you're coming on the show right now? What will it be?
I think that breakthrough is going to be coming along the next couple of years once the NASA Kepler mission is launched and successfully put into operation and it does its first couple of years of observations. What's going to happen is the principal investigator of the mission, Bill Borucki, sometime maybe 2012, 2013, is going to be standing in front of us all at the James Webb Auditorium and NASA headquarters in downtown D.C. giving a major space science update and telling us how many Earths there are in the universe. That is a pretty profound statement.
And maybe that's where SETI can aim, and who knows, once we find out that, hey, there are Earth-like planets, here they are, we know where they are, let's just aim out there. Will we be able to know how old they are?
Yes, basically any star that we find a planet around, we can use theoretical models of how stars evolve to guess how old the star is.
Plus or minus, a billion years or something like
maybe
that?
Maybe a little bit better than that, but yeah, certainly not much better than plus or minus of a billion years. That's sort of the typical. These stars typically are on the order of 5 to 8 billion years old. The sun is actually a little bit younger than a lot of the stars that are in the solar neighborhood, which are lower in mass than the sun, actually, and therefore tend to be a little bit older. And so that's sort of the uncertainty, is if we can tell that a star's age to within 1 billion years, that's doing pretty good. But I think when Kepler makes that announcement, it really will be very supportive of the SETI efforts, because then the SETI folks will be able to say, hey, we're not just looking for a needle in the haystack without knowing how many needles are in the haystack. We'll now know how many needles are in the haystack, and that'll help quite a bit with the search.
So if a planet, Earth-like, very similar, 5 billion years old, what are the possibilities of some kind of life like what we have here in some form or fashion? Pretty high?
If you mean intelligent life and evolved life.
Well, to me, that would go as hard. Let's say primates. Maybe we get to the primate level.
Well, that is essentially where we are. I mean, we're all pretty primate, I think, ourselves, right? We say something like 99% of our DNA is the same as what the chimps have. So
yeah.
if you want to go primate level, you might as well go all the way and say human beings as well. I think the chances of actually finding a nearby planet which have highly evolved life are relatively small. Because often life evolves out of phase with each other. That is, we've only been around for a few hundred thousand years as human beings out of the billions of years that the planet has been there. So it's a relatively small fraction of the entire planet's age. And so the chances of just having us be phased up at the right moment when those folks are phased up to be alive and sending out radio signals are a little bit small. That's why SETI likes to look all across the entire galaxy, because they realize if they really do want to find another civilization that is online at the moment we're online, you know, and trying to text message us or something,
sure.
Then you really better look at a lot of different numbers and to find the one that's able to answer you back right now.
Of course, too, all we have to do is look at some of the ancient texts and zero in on areas. Do you believe that we've been visited at all? You're a scientist. You probably don't.
I would love to see some serious scientific evidence for it. I've not seen anything that's accepted by scientists as proof of aliens. It would be wonderful. I think if that could be proven scientifically, that would top even the Kepler announcement I'm talking about.
I think so, too.
In a few years. If you can actually produce an alien body or an alien spacecraft that stands up to thoroughest type of rigorous scrutiny, we'd all want to know about it. No question about that.
I do believe we're going to come across a different form of travel throughout the universe. We're going to learn how to bend space and time somehow, whether we're going through wormholes or what. I think that's going to be the next latest technology breakthrough 20 to 50 years from now.
That would be wonderful. If you can patent it, I'll go along with you.
I won't be able to patent it because I won't be able to understand it.
No, I actually, when I was a research associate at the NASA Ames Research Center, there was actually one day I looked at my mailbox and there was a folder saying, hey, would you like to fly on the space shuttle? Because this was back in the 1979 era when they were beginning to find shuttle pilots and mission specialists, people with PhDs. And so I thought, goodness gracious, it's fun being a theorist, but wouldn't it be fun to take a ride on a shuttle? So I signed up for the program, see what happened. I got as far as the next questionnaire they sent, which said, all right, tell us about your medical history and so on, and you know, and how tall you are. And I said, well, I'm 6'5", and that was the end of my application.
That was it, too tall for that.
You don't need big people. You know, one spacesuit fits all.
Yeah.
So that was the end of my space career. But if you can get us through a wormhole, I'll be happy to follow you right in behind
that,
you.
I will do that. Well, you know, Carl Sagan came up with that theory and when he wrote Contact.
Yes, indeed. He had some fun with that one.
Some of the moons of some of these gas planets, what are the possibilities beyond Titan? We talked about that. We've got Europa out there, for example. What are the possibilities that the moons may possess living creatures and living organisms?
I think those are quite finite probabilities. Europa in particular is one which has a icy crust over an ocean. The big question, of course, is just how thick that icy crust is. Is it meters or tens of meters or tens of kilometers or hundreds of kilometers? So NASA has plans to somehow in the future send a mission out to Europa and figure out a way of using perhaps a synthetic radar mapping to see how deep that ocean of ice is and see if there's any chance of burrowing down through it to see what's down underneath, as a second step. So we would love to probe that watery ocean in Europa. Titan, of course, is still not particularly habitable right now, but as we mentioned before, is perhaps a wonderful analog for the early Earth. So we would like to do a little bit more chemistry on what's going on in the surface of Titan. Those are wonderful places. And of course, Mars is not a satellite, but it's in many ways analogous to what you might find around a satellite of a giant planet which is orbiting, say, at Mars distance, which we know of many of those such worlds exist around other stars. They do have gas giants orbiting at around 1.5 times the Earth's sun distance where Mars is. And so Mars could be a good analog for a satellite of a Jovian planet in another solar system.
We've had some incredible stories about the possibility of life in systems like Zeta Reticuli. What are the possibilities that these stories, fact or fiction, but that they would go to scientists who will look for planetary systems, who are controlling Kepler, and aim in those directions just to see, hey, you know what, how far-fetched are these stories? Let's check them out.
Basically, scientists will pick their targets primarily for where they know they can find planets the best. In the case of Kepler...
And how do they know that?
Well, it's very basic parameters. For example, if you're trying to find a planet by the Doppler wobble technique, you basically want to have a star which is bright enough for you to get enough photons to be able to measure the wobble of the planet that the planet induces in the star. In the case of Kepler, Kepler is going to be looking at roughly 100,000 stars between 100,000 and 170,000 stars for 3.5 years at least. And so it has to stare at these stars continuously without blinking for that entire period of time without moving itself particularly except to reorient itself with respect to sending data to the Earth. So Kepler is going to be forced to stare at a 10-degree square field of view in the constellations Cygnus and Lyra. And so any of those stars that happen to be in that direction of the sky where Kepler will be staring will be ripe for being investigated. And then Kepler will pick out of those, there are roughly 4 million stars, actually, that have been measured in that field of view.
Jeez.
And Kepler's going to narrow that down to, as I say, 100,000 to 170,000 and pick out the best ones in terms of which ones are the brightest and which ones are of different spectral types, stars a little bit more massive, a little bit less massive than the sun.
It does it on its own?
No, it's it has to be done by hand.
Okay.
People have been doing preparatory work.
It's good, but it's not that good, right?
It will only do what it's told to do, basically. Kepler does not have independent autonomy. It will follow its program. It will be programmed to do what it can. It'll do a certain amount of onboard processing of the data because there's so much data being taken that we can't afford to send all the data back to Earth. So it'll do some processing on the computer and then send the information back to Earth for folks to archive that data, then go back and look at it and see if we can tell if there are periodic dimmings of some of the stars that are indicative of having planets orbit around them. So if there's a star named Zeta Reticuli in the constellation of Cygnus and Lyra, then Kepler may very well be looking at it. But if it's not, it's just not in the cards.
It's not in the cards.
Have a chance to look at that one.
Tell me about Peter van de Kamp, and what do we know about him?
Peter Van de Kamp is a wonderful man. He began really the serious search for planets outside of our solar system back in 1938 when he became director of the Sproul Observatory at Swarthmore College. And he began taking data on a number of stars. He was basically looking for binary star companions. And in one particular star he looked at was called Barnard Star, which had been found in 1916 by Edward Emerson Barnard, who was an amateur astronomer who actually was so prolific at finding comets, he eventually got hired by several professional observatories. And Barnard Star was interesting because it happens to be the second closest star to the Sun. The only closest stars are the Alpha Centauri triple system. And Barnard Star is about 4 light-years away. About 6 light-years away. Alpha Centauri is about 4 light-years away. So Barnard Star is very close by, and that's good because what Van de Kamp was trying to do is to find planets by watching the star wobble back and forth in space as it moves around the center mass of the system. And so the closer you are, the bigger the wobble appears. And so he looked at Barnard Star and took data for something like 25 years until 1963 when he was ready to publish. And he said, hey, Barnard Star has a planet. He thought Barnard Star had a roughly Jupiter mass object orbiting around it with a 24-year period. And that was accepted. It was put into everyone's textbooks. We thought, hey, planet should be there. Here's the first proof. Everything's wonderful. Unfortunately, 10 years later, another fellow came along, George Gatewood of the Pittsburgh Observatory, did a thesis work on Barnard Star using completely different telescopic information and showed there was, in reality, no wobble there at all. Turns out that Van de Kamp had been fooled by a couple of changes in his telescope, some seemingly minor changes in the telescope, a different cast iron cell for a lens, a different plate emulsion. And those seemingly minor changes introduced enough wobble, apparently, seemingly wobble, that Van de Kamp incorrectly predicted there was a planet there. And unfortunately, that planet has since gone away.
Good theory, wrong spot.
Right. And unfortunately, Peter Van de Kamp died in 1995, just before the first extrasolar planets, correct ones, had been found. So he almost lived long enough to see the dawn of the era that he really helped to introduce.
He would be very impressed today, would he not be?
Indeed, he would be just totally amazed.
The planets, the exoplanets, how big do you think they can get? I mean, what's the biggest possible size?
Well, the upper mass is actually is determined by definition by the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, which wants to define a planet.
They're the ones that knocked out Pluto, right?
Exactly, exactly. So if you can burn deuterium, then you are considered a brown dwarf. If you can burn hydrogen, you're considered a regular star. And planets are neither of those. They have to be below 13 Jupiter masses, typically. And so if you're less than 13 Jupiter masses, you are called a planet. We've actually found several objects around solar-type stars, which are probably a bit more massive than that, 14, 15, 20 Jupiter masses.
Jeez, that's big. Alan, we're going to take your phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.